Hello and welcome to this ISV update podcast, this time for a one-day extra board meeting that was held on the 28th of July. I'm Sonja Horn, the communications manager of the ISV and the IFRS Foundation, and I'm joined by Stephen Cooper, a board member of the ISV, and Alan Teixeira, our technical director. This day of meeting saw a small but quite important announcement on IFRS 9, isn't it, Alan?
Yeah, thanks, Sonja. What the board was having a look at is the effective date for IFRS 9, and that's both the 2009 version of it and also the new chapters that we put in 2010. The effective date at the moment is scheduled to be mandatory from 1 January 2013. And what the board is proposing to do is to extend that so the effective date becomes 1 January 2015. Now, the main reason for doing this is that when we set the effective date of 2013, we anticipated that we'd have all of the other chapters finalised by that stage, but we've still got some work to do on impairment and hedge accounting, which we're going to talk about a little bit later in this podcast. And so we thought it's appropriate to at least assess or propose pushing that out by 2 years to 2015. The other issue that's related to that is that we provided comparative relief when we first brought out the classification and measurement part of IFRS 9. And what it did is it relieved people who adopted before the end of this year from having to provide comparatives. Mm-hmm. So it's a much sort of simpler transition for them. And of course that relief expires at the end of this year. So the board's not proposing to actually extend that comparative relief, but we think it's appropriate to ask a question on that as well. So essentially the board's agreed that we would propose extending the date, not extend the comparative relief, and we expect to put an exposure draft out at the end of next week. So that's the first week in August, essentially, for this quite narrow scope exposure. We haven't confirmed the exposure period because it just depends a little bit on how quickly we can ballot this, but it's likely to be between 60 and 90 days, possibly about 75 days.
And that will be only about what happens between 2013 and 15.
Yeah, when you think about what the amendment is, it's changing one letter for one number, I should say, from 13 to 15. But of course, it's the rationale for doing so and what the implications are for suggesting such a change. So it's not the change itself, but it's making sure that people understand the implications and get their feedback, and we can consider that.
Right. And apart from that, most of the day was devoted to hedge accounting and various issues there. Stephen, maybe you want to start off.
Yeah, thanks, Sonja. I guess there were the two key areas that we talked about. One was risk components and the other disclosures. And this largely completes the re-deliberations on hedge accounting. We do have one or two things that we're going to have to look at in September, but essentially the board has pretty much reconsidered the whole model. So to start with on risk components, this was a key element of the exposure draft, the ability to designate risk components for non-financial items. This is one of the major restrictions that we currently have in IAS 39, and many people feel that this makes the hedge accounting that we currently have not as usable, as informative as it really could be. And certainly the ability to designate risk components was one of the most supported aspects of the exposure draft. I guess you could say it had overwhelming support. There were many issues raised, nevertheless, particularly in terms of the drafting, the clarity, making sure it was operational. So a lot of things that we learned from the comment letters. However, the board rediscussed risk components and was supportive of retaining the notion of risk components as eligible hedged items, using a criteria-based approach to determine those eligible risk components. That's essentially the separately identifiable and reliably measurable criteria. But we are going to improve on the way in which we explain that, the way in which we ask for it to be applied. We're going to use a single set of criteria for all items. This is both financial and non-financial. Currently, the separately identifiable, reliably measurable apply to financial items. We're going to continue and use that basis for both in the future. And also, we're going to provide guidance using examples to illustrate how the criteria should be applied and provide some additional examples in that area. So those areas were sort of largely confirming from the ED, but improving at the same time. However, there were two particular issues in terms of risk components that were sort of left incomplete, I guess, in the exposure draft. And one was inflation, and the other one was hedging of credit risk using credit derivatives. The one on inflation, there's a restriction currently in IAS 39 on designating an inflation risk component of a financial item. This is a non-contractually specified inflation risk component, and there's a prohibition in designating that as a hedged item. And many people have questioned whether this blanket restriction is appropriate, particularly given the principle that we're now bringing in about what are the criteria for a hedged item. And many people, I think, feel that even though it's in many cases unlikely that inflation would be non-contractually specified inflation would be eligible as a risk component, there would be situations where it perhaps could be, and that rather than have a blanket ban, that we should rely on the enhanced criteria that we're proposing. So the board supported that and decided that we should remove the blanket ban, but at the same time include a note about exercising caution and including a rebuttable presumption. We have yet to work out the words exactly, but to make sure that it is only when appropriate that we permit that designation. We'll include examples as well within the standard to illustrate how that how it could be and how it may not be an appropriate risk component. So then we went on to credit derivatives and whether it's possible to identify credit as a separate risk component that could be hedged. Now, this is an important issue for the in the banking industry with the use of credit default swaps to hedge credit. And it's always been a problem of the difficulty of identifying separately from fair value changes for a loan or a bond what the credit component has been. And although we didn't put a specific proposal in the exposure draft on this, we did put in the basis some alternatives that we had considered, and we specifically asked for feedback on this. We didn't really come to a final conclusion, I guess, on our sort of favoured method for the exposure draft and wanted to get more feedback on a variety of approaches, which we did. A lot of people commented upon this. We didn't actually reach a conclusion at this meeting. We had a long discussion about it. There were some approaches which were favoured more than others. One board member asked for more work to be done on an insurance approach. I think there was, Alan, unanimous support for trying to solve this issue, but certainly we didn't make a decision about precisely how we would do it, and this is one of the key things that will come back in September.
Yeah, exactly. I could say that the board's always quite happy to ask the staff to do more work on these issues, and but certainly looking at an insurance approach was one way to think about that. So the board realises that it's an important issue. We've got to just get this right.
Mm. There was also a lot of talk about disclosures and timelines.
Yeah, in fact, I guess if you looked at the time we spent in the meeting, because disclosure was a little bit like this, because it tends to be about the detail more than anything else, as much as because you have a look at the disclosure requirements. It's very tricky to get the balance between overloading and trying to be comprehensive, and also making sure that you show the salient points. There were four issues that we had to look at. One was the scope of the hedging disclosure requirements. Second was description of the risk management strategy. Then we looked at timing, amount, and certainty of future cash flows. And then lastly, the effects of hedge accounting on financial statements. Perhaps if I start with the scope, most respondents wanted to limit it to information about what is being hedged and what and how a hedge accounting is being applied, because some of the respondents thought that we should even expand that a little bit, because in other words, try to get a more holistic view of how people are using hedging or to actually manage their risk, which means that they wanted to know not only about what they were doing to hedge, but also which things they weren't hedging. But the board had a look at that, and this is going to work with IFRS 7, which is our financial instruments disclosure requirement package. And there's a lot of information there already about the risks that you've got with particular instruments anyway. And I think the board sit back and on reflection thought that between the requirement that we're looking at in this new standard on hedge accounting to actually explain how you're managing, how you're hedging, and how hedge accounting is applied, that coupled with IFRS 7, which deals with other instruments, that you may not be actually, those instruments may not be held for hedging purposes, but create different types of risks. Between the two of them, we should get a reasonably complete picture of how people are managing risk. The risk management strategy as well was another area. In the exposure draft, basically, what the board was proposing that they provide information about how each risk arises, how they're managing risks, and the extent of risk exposures that the entity has been managing. I think most people agree that this was the right sort of approach to take. So what the board's going to do is to add some guidance so that when entities do provide a description, gives a little bit of clarity about what they should describe. And there are things like, you know, whether the entity hedges an item in its entirety or for all the risks it hedges, whether it's a risk component, what type of hedging instruments are used and how they're used to offset the risk exposure, how they determine the economic relationship between the hedged item and the hedging instrument, for example, for the purpose of testing effectiveness, and basically how they establish the hedge ratio and what sort of the sources of ineffectiveness are. So I guess that's giving a sense to, we've been trying very hard over the last few years to make sure we've got very clear objectives about what we're trying to achieve with the disclosure, but coupled with that, sometimes you need to explain or give some examples of the types of information that would help you achieve that objective, and I think that's what we're trying to do here.
I think, Alan, this is one of the key issues in the whole of the hedge accounting project, because at the moment, hedge accounting is pretty restricted, but it's still very difficult for users of financial statements to work out what on earth is going on, not just in terms of the hedge accounting itself, but what the company is trying to do, what it's achieving as a result of its hedging strategy. And we're proposing an exposure draft that takes a different approach to hedge accounting. We're looking at focusing upon the risk management strategy, looking at hedge accounting more in the context of really the underlying economics of what companies are trying to do. And I think coupled with that, there needs to be a much clearer set of disclosures about the hedging activities and hedge accounting that the companies are doing. And I hope that as a result of this project, we can actually make a massive step forward in terms of the transparency of hedging and hedge accounting. It's important to remember that we're retaining what we had in the exposure draft and adding to it in the terms of risk management strategy. Not that we're, I think, adding to the length of the disclosures. I think we're making it much clearer about exactly what we're asking people to provide. And it includes things like when a risk component is being hedged, how that risk component relates to the entirety of the position that it's part of. We're not requiring disclosures of things that aren't hedged, but we've got to understand how what is being hedged and the hedge accounting that's applied, how that relates to the overall risk management strategy of the company and the entirety of the items that component relates to. So I think this is an important area. I think the feedback that we had on this has helped us refine and add to the requirements here.
I agree. They had a look at a couple of other issues. One was timing, amount of uncertainty, future cash flows, and that. We had a look at potential some of the disclosure components of that, and including the way they might be presented. There are a couple of tricky issues in there. One included sort of, when an entity applies dynamic hedging. And essentially, we've still got a little bit of work to do on that, so the staff have been asked to come back, I think, with some more information in the September meeting. As Steve said, it's a matter of getting this disclosure right. And well, some people will often comment that, you know, we often use disclosures to supplement for accounting, but this is not a case. We're trying to get a complete picture of how people are managing their risks, and particularly using hedging to manage their risks. So in fact, the disclosure is one of the most powerful aspects of this project.
And then there were a couple of sweep issues, as far as I'm aware, that were discussed in the board meeting. Or is there anything to add to the hedge accounting discussions?
Those are, well, the trouble with the hedge accounting, well, it's not a trouble, the hedge accounting is quite a complex issue. There are a couple of other issues. We looked at link presentation. The board decided they wouldn't allow link presentation, so that was fairly simple. We also looked at accounting for contracts for non-financial items could be settled net of cash. They thought that rather than, we had a proposal in the ED to change the accounting for contract to buy or sell a non-financial item and settle it in net cash, or what they call own use contracts. Rather than the proposals there, the board's going to decide to extend the fair value option on IFRS 9 to contracts that meet the own use scope exception.
Yeah, this is quite a limited change, actually. I think it applies to only a relatively small number of companies.
Yeah.
And it's the situation where an entity is managing own use contracts, derivatives, and potentially other assets on a fair value basis, which not many of them arguably do. And if that is the case, how would you then account for the own use contracts? Would it be better to reflect them at fair value? Now, essentially, we're saying a similar thing to what we had in the exposure draft, where yes, they are going to be at fair value, but the way in which it's achieved, we think should be slightly different, and using the fair value option rather than mandating the use of fair value if you manage it on a fair value basis. So it's not a major change as far as the main model is concerned, but it is an important issue in certain industries, power generation, some other areas where this is crucial.
Yeah, and I think Steve said earlier on in the podcast, this pretty much wraps up the main parts of the discussion. So we've got a few smaller issues, some of the disclosure of things to come back, and essentially I think the team are now going to spend much of August in drafting mode, essentially to put the final requirements together, and then obviously we have to come back and look at the whole package as well before we can proceed to the next steps.
Good. Well, anything else before we wrap up? Maybe an outlook, something else that's important that has happened or is happening?
Well, there are a couple of minor things. If people want to have a look at ISB update, which should be published early in the first week of early next week, 1st or 2nd of August, we've had a look at some IFRS 1 first time adopted transitional relief for revenue recognition, and we also had a look at at least a brief discussion of offsetting for asset and liability disclosures. Unfortunately, we did have a problem yesterday with our external provider with our webcast, and we lost two of our board members off the meeting. So we decided not to make any decisions on that project, but at least give the staff enough of an indication of where we're heading on our the offsetting. So there are a couple of other things that will be reported back and updated as well. But the next things to head in the next couple of weeks or so, as we mentioned at the very beginning, there's an exposure draft on effective date for IFRS 9, moving that out. That should be out at the end of the first week in August. We don't have any meetings planned for August at all, so the next time the board meets will be September, which is quite a refreshing break for us. And of course, so just a reminder, this week the agenda consultation document went out, and its comments are due by 30th of November. We'll have quite an extensive amount of outreach to go with that as well, so we're looking forward to getting comments back.
Thank you very much, Alan and Steve, for this podcast. And as always, at the end, the short disclaimer: the views presented in this podcast are those of the presenters and not those of the ISB. For official technical summaries of the ISB meetings, please refer to the IASB update on our website at www.ifrs.org. Thank you.